Welcome to the REI Mastermind Network, where host Jack Haas gathers amazing stories from leaders in real estate investing. In each episode, our guests will tell you what they're doing that works, what they've tried that failed, and best of all, you'll learn actionable steps to take your real estate investing to the next level. Now, here's Jack with another value-packed episode.
We have Aaron Chapman with me here tonight. We're going to talk all things mortgage and financing for your real estate investing endeavors. You can find what Chapman is up to and with his team over at aaronbchapman.com. That's going to be a clickable link in the show notes as always, but really appreciate your time here, Aaron.
Thank you. I appreciate the invite, Jack, and allow me to at least dig into the ears of your listeners.
Yeah, this is going to be a great conversation. I'm going to start things off a little differently, because when you go to your website, Aaron, is it Aaron B. Chapman or is it just aaronchapman.com?
Yeah, either one works. I bought them both. Start with Aaron B. Chapman, then I found Aaron Chapman available, so they all point to the same place.
Okay, great. Your branding, you come here, you look very different from the traditional mortgage provider.
That is definitely on purpose and on accident all at the same time. So there's a story behind it all, but to end up becoming the best thing that could have happened to me was making a decision not to look like everybody else.
Yeah, you probably feel more comfortable at it as well. It seems like there's a lot of putting forward a different face when you're dealing with real estate.
Well, it's interesting the philosophy on how a person needs to look for anything, right? People have a certain expectation with a certain vocation, and I tried to play that role. When I came into the mortgage world, I came from, you know, cattle ranching as a kid to working in the oil fields of Wyoming, the running heavy equipment in Arizona, and then the mines of New Mexico. And then from there to this, a transition took a bit. I had to cut a foot off of my hair, I had to shave, buy some business-like clothes and try and blend into that. But the way I speak and the way I communicate with people is try to get as connected individually as possible. So the person they heard on the phone and the person they saw sitting before them were two different individuals, and there's a trust issue that comes there. So when you start to find that they're not the same person, you now have to overcome a new trust problem. So I decided at one point later, I was like, you know, I'm just going to start going with my way. And then my way started to even evolve even more. Even the reason my beard is even as long as it is. I mean, I went without a beard forever. Goatee was the most I would have. A patch was right here on my face, wouldn't fill in. I got in a motorcycle accident in 08 that tore up that side of my face. I woke up in the hospital with a full beard, and I decided, you know, I'm going to let it grow until I learn how to walk again, because I had to come back from, you know, the financial devastation of an 08 motorcycle crash. On top of that, my legs, I was forced to have to be in a wheelchair for a length of time. I had a head injury that my mind would recycle every 3 minutes. So my memory would wipe every 3 minutes. So I had to come back from all these things, but I at least, you know, had this beard as a progression symbol. And I got to where I could walk again. It was about 3 inches long, and I kept it at that length. Well, I went to a mastermind event in 2016. I don't know if Ron Phillips is part of your network, but Ron walks up to me with a full beard and a shaved head, just like myself. He goes, my beard was longer than yours yesterday. I'm like, well, mine was longer than mine yesterday. I trimmed it for the event. Here's the deal. I won't trim it until I see you again. Now, I would see Ron every 3 to 6 months. I didn't see him for 5 freaking years. Mm-hmm. So you say something, you open up your mouth, and now you got to live by it. So what it was is now this brand enhancement in my life came from me wearing my commitment on my face. Now, the reason I braid it, I'll either braid it one braid or two braids, is I did rescue work for the sheriff's office for just short of 10 years. And there was one day I'm down there, I'm in the middle of packaging a patient up as the helicopters come in, that rotor washer just slapping me in the eyeballs with my beard. So I had to tie it up. And from then on, I just put braids in it to keep it under control. So that's the evolution of the brand that now I can't get rid of.
I appreciate you sharing that story. And I really think it's really important about the trust aspect of things. I mean, there's an underpinning of trusting yourself as much as the person that you're talking to when it comes to this.
And what's interesting about that trust aspect, right? Sometimes they don't remember it. Ron forgot all about it. So that 5 years later, it was actually getting to a point I had to do this just to put my pants on because my belt buckle was getting caught in the beard. So I called Ron and said, you might get on my YouTube channel. He goes, I'd love to. So he got on and we talked a little bit about it. I said, now here's the main reasons on here. So you're on here, Ron. Do you remember this conversation? He goes, I don't. remember that at all. I said, well, we're finally face to face. I got pulled my knife out and I cut that thing in half. And that's where I finally got to trim the beard, and I cut about 8 inches off it. I still need to trim it even a little bit more at that point. But the interesting piece of that was, is he had no idea or no recollection of that conversation, but I did. And the choice that a person has is they can decide whether or not they want to honor what they said to somebody in passing, or if they want to live up to the expectation they set for themselves. And if you're not willing to live up to the expectation you set for yourself, now I get sometimes you want to, you have to change direction. You know, I'm big into writing down what you want to have happen. But sometimes evolution of life changes. You're not always going to, not everything is as important as it used to be. But sticking by a commitment until you've come to terms with that commitment is I think people need to know enough about you to believe that you're that person. So now they will always know I'm that person because I'm walking around with the damn thing still on my face.
Well, if you don't mind me asking, where did this come from? I mean, sticking to your word, even in passing like this, is, we have to face fact. That's kind of a rare breed in our society.
Well, it comes from, you know, cattle ranching days, right? You're young, you're learning from older guys in a place where, and then also in the mines and a few other places, especially out in the rescue world, life and death was a real thing in my life in many places, because if you don't deliver on what you said you were supposed to do or you were told to do, then that could cause a lot of problems for a lot of people. And when you're talking about some of those high stakes environments, people need to be able to count on you. And what they do is they sort through you really fast. If they can't count on you, you are passed by really, really quickly. Nobody's going to take that risk when it comes to their life or other people's lives. But then politics starts working into it into any environment. And you have to kind of weave your way through all that kind of thing too. But I came from just being a kid working around my pop and then working around him because he was a miner when I was growing up. And I remember him talking about these other guys. They referred to their partner underground, the guy who worked directly with them, because you're always in twos because of the safety situation. And then they called them opposites, people on other shifts. There was three shifts always running in when you're underground to keep the mine moving 24/7. And when he's referencing his opposites, he would reference the good ones, the guys that did what they were supposed to. And he could walk into what they call a heading. That's the direction you're heading with your tunnel that you're driving. They called that a drift. And if things were done correctly, they liked their opposite. If they weren't done correctly, these guys didn't stick to their end of the deal. He hated them, and he would sabotage things for those guys, right? And it was just one of those things that they did underground to each other. And if he had a partner that he liked, he would talk about that partner. If you couldn't stand him, same thing. They'd get rid of him. And I got to learn early how valuable it was from the perspective of my dad that being able to count on other people, especially when you're talking about a place like the mines. You know, when you're underground, something's done incorrectly, that's your life right there, or the lives of many other miners. And we've seen those stories, those documentaries of them digging miners out. Well, I had that opportunity to work with him underground. I got that opportunity to be in the mines with him in my early 20s. And when we were doing what we were doing down there, and I was learning that process rather quickly, I was being just dumped into the deep end of the pool. I remember the day that the general mine superintendent was coming through, and we had to stop because he was talking about where we were at, and we were doing a rather specific project. And my dad referenced me. He goes, well, my partner and I are doing X. I know I had made it. I know that I had delivered on what I had said I would do, which was get down there and get the job done. And it feels the feeling a person gets from achieving something that you wanted to be able to achieve since you were a kid. You know, the only way to get there is by honoring the commitments that you make and doing what you're supposed to and following the processes and procedures that you're taught. You never forget that lesson. And it's really very much embedded in you. Another lesson I learned early on, especially when I was cattle ranching with my pop, he was gone. He was somewhere else. And I had to make a decision. I was 16 years old. I had to make a decision about something out there. I don't even remember what the decision was. Well, he comes out there after it's done. The outcome of my decision was very evident. And he asked me, you know, tell me what was going on, what was happening, what was leading up to this, and why you decided to do this. And I explained it all. And he goes, now, this is how I would have done it had I been faced with the same thing. And we went through that whole process. And then he put his arm around me. He goes, but I'm proud of you for making a decision. You didn't just stand there and just watch everything go by. He goes, that right there is a decision itself, not doing anything. He said, so that right there was another pivotal point in my younger years that you need to always be doing something. No decision is the same as a decision. That's truly the wrong decision. Now, you can either make it a slightly incorrect decision, a correct decision, or a vastly wrong decision, or no decision, which will guarantee a wrong decision. So I always tell everybody, keep moving. You always got to keep moving. And you're going to make a mistake. It's going to happen. but make new mistakes. There's nothing wrong with new mistakes. Quit making the old ones, though.
Yeah, you know, you don't probably aren't aware, but I do a lot of wholesaling, wholetailing, and a few other things in my market. And this is one of those things when keeping your word, it is something that we've really kind of ran with in our market when it comes to the way we do business. Because if you listen to a lot of gurus in the real estate world, when it comes to the stuff that we do, you use it as another opportunity. If you can't find a buyer for your property, you go back to the seller and do a renegotiation and all that. Thankfully, we've never done that. We've stuck to it. If we say we're going to buy a house, we've stuck with it. And I think that reputation has kind of stuck with us in that, in the market.
What people don't understand is the reputation will eventually get to a point where it kills your business if you don't continue to be that person. And they will do the best they can to try and go to everywhere but you. You will be the last resort for people if you're the type of person that can't count on that. And it's amazing how many gurus talk about certain things. There's, in fact, back during the crash, you know, 2008, you referenced that earlier. I've heard a lot of people, especially in the real estate game, talking about, well, then you can do a strategic default. And that's a business model and all this thing. And they talk about how they did that in 08. And then if things go sideways, they'll do the same. I can't get behind that. I can't get behind that kind of thing. You need to honor your commitments in especially in the financial world. You definitely have to, people need to be able to trust you. People need to know that you're going to live up to what you said you're going to do. And also, there's a lot of people that are good at taking advantage of people. Situation like what you're talking about. You have a seller now that counted on something. They had an expected outcome. And because you couldn't deliver on what you anticipated, you couldn't, because you know, possibly poor planning. I'm not saying you individually, but a person in general in the wholesaling or wholetailing space. Because of that, they got to go back and put that seller in a bind who knows what commitments they had out there. Now they have to renegotiate their commitments, and it just continues to trickle downward. And to me, that is a predatory practice, a very predatory practice to do that to somebody and back them in a corner like that. There's an old saying, have you ever seen the movie Rounders? But I love that movie. I have my kids watch it when they turn 18 to understand that you're going to have these different people in your life. They all represent a different person. There's one statement that's made in there that says you can shear a sheep many times, but skin them only once. Well, you skin that sheep that one time bad enough, you will never get a chance to go back there. If you honor your word, you get that opportunity to you know, and everybody has a chance to make money or profit from it. You have the ability to shear that sheep over and over and over again. But that sheep has to be able to get fat. That sheep has to be able to generate enough nutrients or intake enough nutrients to grow enough wool to make you money, right? So you got to be sure that they're whole all the time and they're doing well. Because if they're not doing well, they're not going to produce the wool. You cannot shear them. So people have to look at things the right direction, take little bits, not big chunks. Those who try to take the big chunks, you'll be out of business sooner than you want to be.
Yeah. No, so it sounds like you had quite the journey then, going from mining, and then you had the accident and a few other things. With all of that, was it the physical need to go into more of a white collar type role? Like, what led you to doing mortgages and property financing?
I was at an event one time where somebody said that, you know, talked about his journey into the mortgage business. He says, you go into the mortgage business because you can't get a job anywhere else. And it was very, very true for me. So they shut down that mine in northern New Mexico because it was just not producing enough. The ore was just not rich enough. And so they're like, okay, we're going to start closing this down. They started laying people off. I had a very good resume at that point. So I came back to Arizona. I had a wife and an infant son not quite an infant. He was about 6 months old at the time. I was coming back and forth. I do 13 shifts and then six shifts back home and then 13 shifts back in the mines. So when I came back, I'm like, I'll find a job pretty easy. It wouldn't take long. I'd just go throw some resumes out there and get this thing nailed down pretty quick. Well, I couldn't find anything to save my life. I kept getting the term overqualified from everybody I applied with. I couldn't understand this term. I'm 23 years old. What does overqualified mean? Either I can do the damn job or I can't. So I finally got to a point where we were desperate and I needed something. So I found in the paper, this is back when newspaper stuff, 1997, they were advertising $10 an hour truck driving job to haul landscape rock out of Phoenix. So I drove out there and my wife gave me a coupon for free diapers because we didn't have enough money to buy diapers at that time. So as I'm driving out there, I go into the shack they have there in the yard and talk to the superintendent. And I got the exact same response as everybody else, overqualified. So as I'm walking out of that office, trying to keep the tears from flowing out of my eyes, I was under an enormous amount of stress. Walked over to my truck, climbed in, fired it up, went to drive to the grocery store with that coupon to get those diapers, and my gas light comes on my truck. Now, I'd never been in a position in that vehicle to know how long you could go on a gas light. So I went to find the fastest, the quickest place I could find that has a gas station and a grocery store. So I saw one on a corner. I pulled in there, pulled up to a gas pump, pulled out my debit card because it's the only form of payment I had, said a quick prayer, swiped my card, and I got a decline because I was overdrawn. I went through my rifled through my truck, looked for maybe a lost dollar. I found a couple of coins. I locked the door. I started walking that parking lot. And it's a pretty big parking lot. And I found enough change to get a couple gallons of gas over a couple of hour period of time. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in this position. Doesn't feel good to look around and make sure people aren't looking at you before you pick up that quarter or that nickel or that dime or that penny you just saw. And then get these two big pockets full of change. Back when gas was about 89 cents a gallon. So two good things for me at that time. Gas was 89 cents a gallon and people carried change. So I was able to pick up enough to get that done. I go into the store. I find the diapers that corresponded with the coupon. And I stood in line with my one item with a coupon to pay for it, right? And again, you have that kind of feeling. Hurriedly got out of there as fast as I could. And as I had my head down heading through the door, I heard my name called. I turned to face a guy by the name of Keith, who used to work at one of the companies I ran heavy equipment with. He ran the office. He asked me how things were. I glazed over it quickly because I did not want to share my current circumstances. Well, he said, let's go to dinner. I'm like, I'm not in a spot financially right now to be able to go out to dinner, man. He goes, no, I got a gift certificate from a client. You know, I said, client? He goes, yeah, I'm no longer working over at that excavation company. Let's meet at Red Lobster. So we went there and he shared with me the mortgage industry. So that's where I cut that foot off of my hair, shaved. I went and met the branch manager of a little broker shop that Keith introduced me. And then I started as a telemarketer in December of 1997. So it's definitely circumstances that forced me into this. So I look back on that and I think on that experience. And by the grace of God, was my prayer answered in a different way than I anticipated. Some people think that my prayer was not answered because I got a decline on that card. But if that card worked, I'd have gotten my gas a lot quicker. If I found coins faster to get those couple gallons of gas to get out of there, I would have never seen Keith. If fewer people dropped coins, it took me longer to find it, I may not have seen Keith. It was a perfect timing scenario to meet Keith. Now, was it easy to take that path? No. It was one of the most miserable damn things I've ever experienced in my life is sitting on a phone and calling off of a list. I was able to generate some leads, convince that branch manager to allow me to work some of those leads. And that's how I started in the industry in 97. And now, 20 some odd years later, I've been ranked in the top 10 people in the United States. There's over 1.1 million people that do my job. In 2022, the rankings came out. I was number 7 in the United States for transactions closed. I don't know where I ranked in 2023. I haven't seen the rankings, but I would say I was ranked number 1 for many years as the number 1 conventional lender in the real estate investment space, as far as doing loans for in real estate investors, doing over 100 to 150 transactions a month for a guy who used to, you know, break rocks for a living. So I'm very, very blessed to have been given the opportunity and then using what I know about life and other things to apply it towards the mortgage side of it to create a process that's still very, very unique in the industry and has yet to be duplicated.
So if you want to learn more about what Aaron is up to, go to aaronchapman.com. Like I said, that's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. If you like what we're talking about so far, do us a quick favor and share this with one of your investor friends. And if you're watching us on YouTube, like and subscribe. So Aaron, we got to talk about the mortgage industry and what we're seeing in the economy right now. And I haven't seen the market the way it is right now. With interest rates as high as it is, I am still seeing, frankly, a shockingly high demand product that we're producing. Are you seeing that as well?
A very, very high demand for it. It really just boils down to the inventory and the availability, right? People still need housing. People still need a place to rest their head. People still have this desire for ownership. Investors still have a desire to build their portfolio, but we are lacking in construction. You know, the National Association of Home Builders is focusing on multifamily, not on single family. And then you have the hedge funds focusing on single family. 44% of the single families were purchased by the hedge funds in 2023. It's speculated that they could own as much as 60% of the available single family housing by 2030. So there is a massive demand, and we actually have what looming overhead, a high probability of us not being able to get our hands on single family housing very easily in the future. So I'm highly encouraging real estate investors jump on that now. Now I get the want for apartments and to be the baller and have the big projects and all that stuff. But you've got to be able to walk before you run. If you're thinking about starting real estate investing, there really is no better time than right now. Sure, everybody can lament about the interest rates of the past, and there can be those who speculate that we're going to see those interest rates again. And I'm sorry, I don't believe we're going to. I've been screaming on my YouTube channel for about, I guess it started when COVID hit in 2020. So I started that YouTube channel just to notify my clients what's happening in the market and what they can expect, because there was such a big whipsaw and things with COVID's impact on the markets that I couldn't communicate to everybody. I need to give them a way to hear from me what's happening and what to expect. And I just kept it going twice a week since then. And what we have right now is this anticipation of this big drop in interest rates, especially with what the Fed's going to do. Well, they just left rates alone. I guarantee they're probably going to leave rates alone again, because inflation has to get under control, and it still isn't under control. Why is inflation not under control? Because people won't stop freaking spending. We have this problem in our country that we have been so well programmed with the media and with the way that people have been able to tap into the human brain and really manipulate your pleasure centers to where you have this instant gratification situation going on. People love to click on Amazon and buy something. And sometimes that shit just sits in the box, because all you wanted was the click. You didn't really need the item. So because of that consumption, we are now still facing continued inflation. And what's real so interesting is the CPI is not even a real good reflection of inflation. You know, the Fed uses this index to focus on only certain things. It's kind of like saying, well, you got the NASDAQ, you got the NYSE, and you got the Dow. Are those the exact same value? Well, no, they're not the same value, because they have different things in them. The same reason that inflation, as it is right now, in the real rates of inflation are not reflective of what's really in the CPI, because CPI only watches those few things in that specific index. One way to illustrate this to people, and this is an important thing for them to understand, is that inflation is eroding the value of the dollar, not pushing the value of things up. So if you go all the way back into the 20s, right, actually pre-20s, they used to mint a $20 gold piece. I actually have one. I don't have it with me right now, or I'd show it. And you could go into a department store and buy a hat, a suit, a tie, a shirt, a belt, a pair of pants, I mean, that's part of the suit, a pair of socks and a pair of shoes for that $20 gold piece. But today, you can't take $20 into a department store and even get a pair of socks, hardly. It'd probably be a mid-grade sock, right? But what's interesting is you could walk into a department store and get all those things I mentioned for an ounce of gold, because an ounce of gold is $2,500-ish, right? I don't have a little gold. So what that tells me is that value of the gold and the value of the material still has not changed. It's the instrument that we're exchanging for it that has changed, which is the U.S. dollar. So what has really, really caused a lot of our problems happens to be the Fed doing what they call quantitative easing. You familiar with that particular term?
I am, but our listeners probably aren't. So we maybe have to explain a little bit.
It's a very amazing thing to me how many people don't remember that term. So quantitative easing was put in place by Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke back in 2008. It's when they started talking about it. And it was a way that the central bank to take money from the U.S. Treasury and invest it into the economy. And how they invest it was in through the treasuries, you know, the 10-year T-bill, and into the mortgage-backed securities and other long-term bonds to put things to work. Now, our interest rates had jumped to a certain point. Because lending pretty much halted. It's not even so much that the rates jumped so much, but lending halted. Nobody wanted to lend any money because they were hanging on to their capital, didn't want to lend it out. So the Fed said, well, we're going to give it to you to lend it. And how did they do that? By putting it into the mortgage-backed securities. What is a mortgage-backed security? A person needs to go watch The Big Short. If you haven't seen it, go find that movie. It's actually on Amazon right now. The Big Short explains the history of the mortgage-backed security. A guy by the name of Lou Ranieri with Salomon Brothers was looking at the banking world and noticed that community banks would take deposits in their checking and savings account. They'd pay the community a certain amount of return to hold their money in those accounts, you know, checking, savings, CDs. That they'd lend the money back to the community. And back at that time, they'd lend it 17, 18%. But they're paying, say, 3% on a checking account, 5% in a savings account, about 8% in a CD. People were making good money on their accounts back then because they were using that. The bank's making money and they're paying them to use their money. That's not the case anymore. So now you've got them, you know, this Lou Ranieri guy looking at this saying, these banks are making a spread somewhere in the range of about 15% average. Well, probably been about 13% average spread on this, because we need to do that. So what they did is they created these big pools of money that pension funds and mutual funds and other big corporations and countries would put money into. They'd lend it out through mortgage channels nationally collect interest back then of 17-18%, and then pay these guys a small piece of it. And then, of course, the guys who are managing the bonds would take a big piece of it. And all of a sudden, the bond world became very, very sexy because they're making an enormous amount of money. Well, what happened is they're running out of mortgages to do because it was just regular 30-year fixed deals. And there's a famous line in the movie that says, who the hell doesn't pay their mortgage? Now, this is leading up to the late 90s when I got into the business. That's when they started introducing these no income, no asset types of loans. Bank statement loans, you know, you're making up your income type of deals based on your credit score. And then you started getting to that point. And the reason they did that, because people were wanting to buy mortgages. Just what do you can give me? Just give me a mortgage deal because it's a great deal. It's backed by the property itself that somebody put up. And the property values were going up like crazy in the early 2000s and late 90s. And the interest was high. They're making 7-9% on their money. And it's backed by ability to repay plus the asset itself, which is the mortgage. It's a no-lose deal. So everybody wanted it, but they ran out of people that were borrowing money on houses. People were staying in houses for 20, 30 years, but people weren't changing so much. So then they had to create different ways to lend the money out. That's where they got really creative with all that. And that was the downfall of the mortgage-backed security in 2008. So we had that crash. Nobody wanted to put money in the mortgage-backed securities. And it's all explained why in The Big Short. Then you have Hank Paulson, who was head of the Treasury, Secretary of the Treasury, and then you've got Ben Bernanke, who is the chairman of the Fed, sits down there, okay, let's go ahead and do this. We're going to take, it was $1.25 trillion starting January 1st of 2009 to the end of March 2010 that they injected into it. But if you look back and do I have the ability to do a share screen? I hope so, because I want to share this with you guys. Okay, let's see if we can do this. So what I'm going to show you is the actual mortgage-backed security itself. There we go. So this is the chart that shows the security itself and it trading. So what we're looking at here, and I'm gonna stretch this thing out all the way to 2008, so you guys can see it. Actually, interestingly enough, this only goes back to 2008 when I stretch the whole thing out. So if we go all the way back here we go. Right here is November 23rd, 2008. It's right where my cursor is. Now, you can see on the screen here, look at all these things. Every single one of these lines represents, I believe, a week's worth of trading, these up and down lines. But what you're looking at here, this yellow line I placed here, that represents the day that they came out, November 23rd, 2008, and said, we're going to do quantitative easing. And this is what that means. So all these investors jumped in and piled money into the mortgage-backed security. So everything before this was pre the announcement of the quantitative easing. Everything after this was after the announcement of quantitative easing. And what this security shows is the volume of money available within it. So this line says this is the day they announced it. This orange line up here is the day they actually started putting money in it. And what you'll notice here is we've only had up days. It's only been up. And it's been up very high from the day they announced it till this day right here, which was end of October 2021. At the end of October, I believe it was October 23rd, 2001, they announced quantitative tightening, meaning we're no longer going to invest in this. We're just going to leave what's in there, but we're not going to put any more money in it. We're not going to keep it recurring. Well, what this represents from this line here, from January 1st of 2009 all the way to the end of 2021, is $8.9 trillion invested into the markets. $8.9 trillion. Well, what happened the day they announced it? It fell off of a cliff. And then it was back in this area here where I started my YouTube show talking about COVID. There's you can see a blip right here, a massive drop right there. That represents when COVID hit, we had a $1 trillion drop. They injected $1 trillion in 10 days. Just to keep this on this trajectory. So zoom in a little bit here and we start to see, it's going to take me a bit to get this to zoom right so we can see it a little bit better, this line. So back here, I started my YouTube channel way back here. I was talking about, and I did some research. I'm thinking, okay, what happened back when they started this quantitative easing? I found that line the day they announced it, and I drew that line all the way across. And I noticed that we are breaking through that. I'm like, you know, And I started putting this out on my channel. Once we're breaking through this line, I think that's going to be our ceiling. Well, it broke above it, but it kept playing along that ceiling until the 200-day moving average shoved it below it, and it kept it below it, and it kept it below it. And like, I think that's going to be our ceiling. And so I started announcing to the whole world, I don't think our interest rates are going to get below what this point is right here, because that means money, there has to be enough money to push above it and convincingly stay above it. And I believe that has to come from federal involvement. Well, right here, it turned around. That was October of this last year. It shoved right up, and where'd it hit? Right on the line that I predicted over a year and a half before. And it kept hitting it, kept hitting it, kept hitting it. It will not get above it because there's not enough money flowing into the markets to do that. So what I'm trying to explain that to most of the people I'm doing business with is you don't expect our interest rates to get any better than they are right now, because we have this barrier that all these traders are looking at saying there's no value above there for us to put that money in there. There's too much risk to put it in there. And what we'll notice here is this last year, 2023, excuse me, yes, 2023, the lowest interest rates, this represents the lowest interest rates or the lowest volume in that particular security since 1996. Highest interest rates we've seen since 1996 back in 2023, and we still had record volume of purchasing going on and property values screaming up, even though it was the highest interest rates we've seen since 1996. Why? Low supply, high demand. I don't know that our supply is going to catch up with our demand the way things are structured. Now, looking at this from a 30,000 foot view, looking at it from an understanding of what goes on in the markets, what manipulates the markets, and who's really benefiting from the market being manipulated the way it was, the hedge funds are benefiting significantly by them doing that quantitative easing. That quantitative easing, you have all these people locked into mortgages in the three. They're not going to sell unless they're forced into it somehow. They're so used to, we have a generation of people, a generation of home buyers that think that that's a regular or average interest rate. We have a generation of people in my industry. There's people that just got in the industry during that window, right? That keep saying, oh, it's a 5-year cycle. It always go back in 5 years. We have a 13-year window with quantitative easing that is different than any market cycle. It's completely manipulated. We're not getting back to that. I just proved that with the line that I referenced. So what that boils down to, there's a lot of people are not going to get into the market that should. It's leaving opportunity open for the hedge funds to jump in and just keep grabbing and keep grabbing and keep grabbing. Even Jeff Bezos started up a hedge fund just to purchase residential housing. So what I explained to a lot of investors, you need to understand the real value in real estate. And it's not having the lowest interest rate. It's not having the best cash on cash return. And it's not having the best cap rates. It's understanding how leverage benefits you and how inflation benefits you. Now, there's this incorrect quote saying that Einstein coined this statement that compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world, right? Well, it's incorrect. Einstein never said that. But what's interesting, though, still take that. It is a wonder of the world, but nobody ever equated that with inflation. When you start looking at interest and how that plays, and you're using a deflating instrument like the US dollar, you're really never paying what you thought you would pay. So I have this tool that I had created, and I actually have an app that I will share with your audience that I had created for the benefit of real estate investors. So let me share another screen here so everybody can see this. Hopefully this one comes up. Are you re-seeing? Not yet. Okay, here we go. So here's this tool. Today's average interest rate for your average investor buying with a 30-year fix is about 7.625%. That's what we're locking mostly for. We have some other deals going on that's better than that, but those are isolated deals that we deal with specific builders that people call me about, and we can introduce you to how to get interest rates of retro back a few years on a 30-year fix with no points. But the average person right now is paying 7.6%. So now let's say you're getting a $200,000 purchase price, putting 20% down, which would give you a $160,000 loan. Well, over those 30 years, you're going to pay $407,689.20 on that payment. And amazingly, we are all programmed to think, take your cash flow, pay it off. Do the debt snowball. Take everything you can to pay off your mortgage. And I'm here to tell you to quit that shit. Don't think that way. And here's why. You have the ability to keep raising rents, keep increasing your income on this. You also have somebody paying off your mortgage. That's a growth in itself. And we'll get into those numbers in a minute. But here's the big thing here. When you recalculate the value of the dollar every time it leaves your hands, it's worth about 0.666% less than it was the month before. When you look at the average rate of inflation since the early 80s, that means taking that into account, that $407,689 over a 30-year period on a $160,000 loan is equivalent to your something changed right here, $154,336.97. Inflation erodes the dollar at a level that you're paying back less than what you borrowed. So when that sinks in, you start to understand the longer you take to pay, the less you actually pay. The lenders are the ones who lose. Now, a lot of people are refinancing every 3 to 4 years, actually every 4 to 6 years, the average refinance for the average person home. You know why they do that? Why would you guess that they do that?
Take advantage of lower interest rates.
Correct. Who do you think benefits the most from that?
Well, I would think they would think they are, but based on what you're saying here now, I don't know if that's the case.
It's the banks who benefit. They have programmed people to think that way. Again, consumer-based, they've figured out how to tweak the consumer's mind and make them understand what's better for them that's really actually better for the banks. What is the first 5 years of a 30-year amortized loan look like?
Well, you're not paying any principal hardly at all.
Barely any. I'll show you a case study here. I've got a client of mine that came to me with started with a $120,000 loan. He wanted to refinance that mortgage because the rates had come down a certain amount. And he'd been paying on it for 47 months. I looked at this. So how much cash do you want out? Because I train my investors. If you're doing a refi, take cash and buy another investment property. Make the two investment properties pay you, right? Oh, no. I just want to refinance it. I said, dude, you're not getting anywhere by doing it that way. I tried and tried and tried to convince him, but I couldn't. But here's how the numbers worked out. Started out with a $120,000 loan. He got to the 48th payment. By the time he got the loan closed, he paid 48 months on that. He had paid it down, actually paid out just over $37,000 in payments. That's how much money left his pocket to make payments on that loan. But once he did the refinance or looked at the balance was only down by about $6,200. So when he did the refinance, had just over $6,100 in fees. His new balance was $119,890. He was within $105, I think, of his original balance after paying for 48 months. And he was happy with that because his payment went down. So what happened was is he gave the banks approximately $31,000 in interest and then reset it again to a high interest level. And if he keeps doing that exact same thing for the next 20 years, he'll have paid out over $180,000 in payments but never dropped his balance. See who's winning in this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bank is really making bank.
They're making a lot of bank off you because they got your mindset. The mindset right for them. So I'm trying to train them. The mindset is wrong by paying these things off. Ride that son of a bitch into oblivion so they don't make that off you. Now, here's where the real value in long-term holds on real estate is. Aaron Chapman's opinion, you guys can tell me I'm full of crap. I don't care. But I'll go Pepsi challenge against anybody else who says they know where the real value is in real estate. So we're going to do some math together. You got a calculator. It's going to be simple math. I'm not going to try and trick you. Sure. So I showed you the spreadsheet here. We had a $200,000 purchase, putting 20% down. What's 20% of 200,000?
40,000.
40 grand. And we're going to say this is the shitty deal. You got $10,000 in closing costs between lender, appraiser, title, insurance, taxes, all that. 10 grand. So how much are you now investing?
Well, 50,000.
50,000 invested. That's what leaves your pocket. But you're getting a $160,000 loan, right? Now your job, you have two jobs as a real estate investor, right? You got to pick the right team to work with, and then you got to get the right asset, which is the right property you keep reasonably rented the entire time you own it, and that you can raise rents on, and it appreciates at least 2.5%. That's what I look for, minimum 2.5. If you did that, who pays off the $160,000 mortgage?
Well, the person you're renting to.
The tenant or group of tenants over 30 years. Right. So we take the $160,000 divided by 30. So let's do that math real quick. What's $160,000 divided by 30? And everybody listening, check his math. Let's see what he's got. I don't think you're expecting math on today's show.
Where no, going. But 53. It's $5,300.
$5,333.34 to be more precise, right?
Right.
So I'll argue that's what your tenant's going to give you over a 30-year average every year, approximately $5,333. If you divide that into your 50,000, that means your 50,000 is growing by 10.6%, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You're making 10.6% on your money without a single dollar of cash flow coming in. Where else are we doing that predictably? We're really not. It's amazing to you how many people say, well, you know, if I left my money in the stock market, but dude, the ups and downs and the swings, come on, let's not get into that kind of stuff. But 10.6%, we've got that. So we're going to shelf that. We know that that's the deal. And we talked about the fact we live in an inflationary environment. What's the average house going up in value right now across the United States?
Well, it's got to be at least that.
Yeah, we're seeing 5-6% in some markets. We saw 8.9% average in 2023. Mm-hmm. And you start looking at Case-Shiller, Black Knight, and CoreLogic. That's what they claimed. Let's just say 2.5%. That's what I like to use. What's 2.5% of 200,000?
Well, it'd be $2,500.
$5,000. It's $5,000, right?
Yep.
That means your $50,000 investment just went up by how much? What percent?
You're starting to lose me a little bit. So 2.5.
So you got 2.5% of 200,000 is $5,000, right? That's what the increase is. But you invested 50,000, so you made 5,000. How much did your investment go up by? Your
50? Oh, 10%.
10%. That's another 10%. So just by having people pay off your mortgage, you're at 10.6. By your house appreciating only 2.5%, you got another 10 on your investment. You're at 20.6% before a single dollar of cash flow. Where else is that happening in your world? It's not. So you've got this asset being paid off, right? You've got this money coming in from your tenants. You've got this appreciation. And now we get into the point of the rents. Let's say you're only making $100 a month cash flow on this mortgage. You're going to look at this. You're screaming by this house like, that looks like a good deal. It's a nice house, new build home. But I'm only making $100 in cash flow at the end of the day. That's not a good deal. The only people would walk away from that, not knowing that they were making a dumb decision because they think that they need to have a 12% or 9% or 15% cash on cash return. No, you need to have something that's a stable asset that will continue to grow for you. So if you're running it for $1,800 a month and you're only making $100 a month cash flow, I'm telling you, you're getting a hell of a deal because that there you can raise the rents on. Now you want to look at places you can raise rents on. So we're seeing average rents going up 5-6% some places. Let's say 3% of $1,800. You know how much that is?
Why don't you just tell me at this point?
$600? $54. That's it. So are you going to get excited about a $54 increase in rents?
No.
No, you weren't excited about $100. You're not excited about $54. The benefit is, does your tenant get excited about it?
Yes.
They think that's awesome. It's only a $54 increase, right? They're listening to their kid that's living in an apartment saying, my rent went up $200. Like, ours is only $54 and we got a four bedroom, two bath, right? They're happy. Mm-hmm. They're not going anywhere. Well, when you run the numbers, you're making $100 a month cash flow the year before. Now you're making $154. That's a 54% increase in your cash flow. Look at that compound growth. What you're seeing is by raising your rents only 3%, you're going to see a double digit compound growth going forward. By year five, you'll achieve that cash on cash you thought you had to have. And now you've also been getting 20.6% on your money every year for those 5 years. Look at the growth you've got. But people start to then realize is that being a real estate investor has a lot broader than just what's my cash on cash return. What does my pro forma look like? I am glad that there's a lot of people out there that are still looking at those returns and still looking at that pro forma for that because they're walking away from the deals that I'm taking. And the real estate investor who's armed with this data, that understands this data, that's working with the right people that are helping them understand it and see it, they're taking advantage of it and getting in buying houses right now when others are walking away from great opportunities and letting the hedge fund take them. I'm a big proponent, not only of understanding it, but also what is the next generation going to have? Right now, my family trust, I didn't have this growing up, right? I had to create this. I have to be the first in my family to do this, create the trust that buys houses, that puts my children in, because they can't afford to buy them right now. It's impossible for a two-income household of 20-year-old kids to 25, 26-year-old kids to be able to buy these houses. I got two grandkids. I got three kids that are married. I got one kid left in the house that's in high school. They don't have a shot at this unless we jump in and help them out. I'm not going to just give them the money. The trust is going to buy the house. We pay cash for them. Here's how I go about it. I go to finance these houses. I go buy it or my wife buys it. Our trust is the buyer. My LLC is the lender. So I lend money to the trust via the LLC. We go in and pay cash for it. We put a note and a deed of trust on that asset when we purchase it from our LLC. Then the individual who is, whether it be my wife or I, we go and do the refinance on it and pay off that LLC note. So now we get a rate and term refinance. So I don't have to go through the crap of trying to get the financing done under duress in the purchase. Now I tell everybody, if you want to come with me, it's not going to be, my team is very, very, very well structured. I will go head to head with anybody that claims that they got a great team because we can get stuff done still in 14, 15 days if everything lines up. But if you need to have that little bit of a competitive edge to do cash the way that I do, because I can't use my team to do my financing, I got to use somebody else. And what I find out when I do my own loans is how great my team is and how much the industry sucks and how much more we can do better in other places. So I just pay the cash and then I can wait the time to get the refi done, the 45, 60 days, because it takes everybody else so stinking long. So when I do it that way, if I'm good with my math and I find a place that's actually worth a lot more than what I'm paying for, I go to do that refinance. I pay off that note that I put on it. I'm in the deal for a lot less, maybe 10%, maybe 0%. And then we put that into the family trust. It stays in the family trust from the day of contract all the way through. It always stays in the trust. You can get conventional financing Two, you're living revocable trust, and that's how we set it up. Then one of my kids moves into it. They pay rent to the trust. Now, they pay enough to cover the mortgage plus $200. Why $200? It's not for cash flow reasons. It's because everybody in the trust puts an extra $200 per month in for every house that they're in, and we self-warranty it. Within 18 months, we've got $30,000, $40,000 in there. And if something breaks on one of the houses, we sit down as a trust, we do a vote, and we fix it. And we keep those accounts up. So that's how we do it. We self-warranty. We self-bank. We use my life insurance policies for the purchases of these things. Everybody in the trust has to have life insurance policies. And I try and guide my real estate investors to do the exact same thing or something similar to be sure that they have security in their family's life, that their children have a security and their grandchildren have a security and continues to go on. Now, the steps that I've taken, the outcome of all this will not be seen by me. I will die before I see all the benefits, but my grandkids will be very well set with a well-structured process and every day I'll have a place to live, but they don't have to worry about trying to go to their own bank and try and make it happen because we'll take care of it ourselves.
Wow, that was a lot to unpack, Aaron, and I can understand. Go to the YouTube channel, REI Mastermind, and to see some of the graphics that Aaron shared there. But more importantly, definitely check out aaronchapman.com to make connections and learn how Aaron's team can help you set this all up and make sense of all of this. Aaron, we've been kind of pushing the time here, but this has been the fantastic amount of material and value you've brought to the show. But before we change gears here and close this episode out, is there a question or concept that you think we should still cover before we jump into the rapid fire?
Well, the one thing we need everybody to do is you can also email me, just aaron.chapman@snmc.com, Sierra November Mike Charlie as in Security National Mortgage Company. You can also go through the website and I'll get you an email. Just ask us for the app, the calculator app. Now you can go to your app store and just download it. It's the QJO investment tool. You'll find it in there by typing those words, QJO, which stands for Quit Jerking Off Investment Tool. As I tell everybody who's searching for the right interest rate, that's all you're doing is jerking off, wasting your time on things of zero value. And what I want you to email me for is I want to send you the videos on how to use the app. You can calculate the same stuff I just calculated for you on my app. So it's the QJO investment tool. That's the one thing that we need to do there. Set up the time. Reach out to my assistant, Bree. Go to my website. Send a message. Hunt us down. Hell, let me give you my damn phone number, 602-291-3357. Text me. Say, I heard you on the show. Set up a time to talk. I'll send it to Bree. She'll schedule a call so I can block the whole world and focus on that conversation and help you get started on where I believe. This is my beliefs, is the holy grail on where to get going and how to build this up for the future.
Well, Aaron, that's a very generous offer. Again, aaronchapman.com. Well, Aaron, are you ready? We'll fly through these rapid fires.
Fire off, man.
What lie do real estate investors tell themselves and sometimes to others?
The greatest lie is I could do it myself.
Do you have a book recommendation or what are you reading right now?
So the greatest book I have ever read outside of scripture is called The Master Key System by Charles Hanna. The reason it is the greatest thing I've ever read is Napoleon Hill references that there's some videos out there that Napoleon Hill did and he references The Master Key quite a bit. It was a correspondence course written in 1910. Rather than just read the book, every chapter is a lesson from the course. What the person would do, they'd write in, they'd get their lesson. You'd read that chapter or lesson every day for a week and do the mental exercise at the end of the chapter. And then it would progressively take you to a point where you're able to then control your thoughts, focus your thoughts instead of getting them scattered. Napoleon Hill talked about it in the book, Outwitting the Devil, where he referenced that the devil told him in a conversation that the way that he controls people is by causing them or influencing them to drift, by giving them thoughts all the time, pushing thoughts in their head, so they're never concentrating any one thing. This book right here, The Master Key System, if you follow it, it takes you 24 weeks to do it properly. You then can now concentrate on what you need to concentrate and keep out the extra thoughts that diminish your energy and diminish your focus.
If you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I give myself that damn book because it took me not until I was 40 years old till I started picking up books. I'm 49 years old. People don't believe it, but I'm an old son of a bitch. And the first book I picked up that I really sat down and read was called The Goal by Eli Goldratt. Changed my life in business. that was a required reading from Harvard. I thought, those guys need to read that stuff, then I'll read it. It's a great book. But then it's put me on a reading path, and I've actually written books. I have books on Amazon. They're a little 30-pagers, so people can get through it quick. But Robert Allen just wrote the foreword for my new book that I just got a publisher signed with yesterday. And now that's going to come out later this year in, I believe, August. So I'm going to come back on the show to promote it.
Oh, that'd be great. What single strategy, process, or tool have you implemented that has had the biggest time-saving impact?
So reading that book, The Goal, by Eli Goldratt, they talk about the theory of constraints. You know, finding your bottleneck. Your process is only as fast as your tightest bottleneck. And so implementing a process to find bottlenecks and actually open them up. So I really did that by going into Chipotle and standing in line waiting to get a burrito. And I realized they had 13 people working at Chipotle to build a burrito. I'm like, why do they need that many people to be efficient at burrito construction? But there's only two people in my team doing an intricate financial instrument like a real estate investment loan. So now I have over 20 people on my team to follow that same method. Everything from the initial, you know, I want a burrito or a salad, all the way to the cash register ringing is all done on my team. You don't go to different departments. You don't need an underwriting department. You don't need a processing department. You don't need a funding department. They're all on my team. They're all directly work on my deals and my deals only. So we found the efficiency in somebody else's business model.
Well, Aaron, this has been great. I look forward to you coming back and talking about your book. It is aaronchapman.com. That's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. Great to meet you, and I hope to talk again really soon.
Well, thanks, buddy. I appreciate you letting me on, and thank you guys for listening. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Have you learned at least one actionable step to incorporate into your real estate investing? If so, please consider returning some of that value by leaving a positive review, subscribing to our YouTube channel, or joining our growing network on Facebook and Twitter. You can find links to all of our social media accounts in the show notes. See you next time.